The following program is being brought to you on the Green Talk Network. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit thegreentalknetwork.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability. Your hosts are Bill Reed and John Becker, co-authors of the Integrative Design Guide to Green Building. This program will help you take sustainability to the next level. Here are your hosts, Bill Reed and John Becker.
Well, welcome back, everybody. It's John.
And Bill.
And we are on our third episode here. Our first one, we talked about what are green buildings, and our second episode, what are systems. Today, we want to talk about what does it mean to sustain life. And we have a guest with us who will be joining us shortly, Dr. Gerald Wilhelm from the Conservation Design Forum. And to kick this off, what we really want to begin to explore is understanding humans as nature as opposed to being separate from nature. And Bill, you had given me a book a while back that I think does a great job really introducing this idea.
Yeah, we give it to not only, well, we give it to our clients to read as well, especially the introduction, but it's a thesis project from University of California at Berkeley by M. Kat Anderson called Tending the Wild. And in it, she introduces the concept, now being introduced by many authors and scholars, that compares the relationship of native peoples before European settlement of North America. She compares the European, and these books, other books, compare the European, the relationship of native peoples to nature, if you will. In fact, that relationship was so close that there was no, and Jerry will talk a little more about this, there was actually no perception that nature was different than humans.
We have this idea. They didn't even have a word for nature, right?
I've learned that from Jerry through you, John. That,
yeah.
What Jerry? Well, Jerry isn't here yet. But what was that, John, about nature? The concept of nature and the native peoples.
Well, what Jerry taught me a while back was he studied several Native American languages, and I think that there were somewhere on the order of 260 of them prior to European settlement. What's fascinating, and to me actually quite profound, is that none of them had a word for nature. And think about that for a minute, brother. I mean, what does that tell you?
Yeah.
It tells me that culture could not even conceive of a concept that nature was some force or thing outside of them.
We have what is called today by philosophers a dualistic mind. We say humans, nature, cultural systems, natural systems. I would say in the English language, we probably don't have one word that combines all that unity. Someone said that creation might actually hold that, and I think they're right, but it really doesn't. We don't use that in day-to-day language. We always say, nature is out there, we're here. And in order to achieve a sustainable condition, which is really what this is about, and some of you may be wondering, well, what the heck we're talking about nature if we're talking about sustainability, but sustainability ultimately is about sustaining life.
Well, let's redefine sustainability. Now, we talked about this a little bit in a prior episode, but I always like to go back to Jonathan Port's definition. Very simply, if it's sustainable, you can go on doing it indefinitely. If it's not, you can't. However,
so buildings in themselves can't be sustainable. And when we're talking about sustainable building or building green buildings, that's a necessary step, but it's insufficient. We really have to change our relationship with the very life support, the web of life that supports our lives.
So Bill, how would you, in as quickly as possible, define sustainability?
Whoa. Well, that's an interesting... It's interesting. We really don't have a sufficient definition for the word sustainability. We use the Brundtland Report that... I've stopped using it for so long, I really don't even remember it. But basically that we have to be able to provide for future generations. Now, that's fine. That gives us an abstract concept of what we are going towards, but what does it really mean?
Oh, yeah, what's its purpose? What's the purpose?
And what does it look like? We don't have a clue because we aren't sustainable right now. We're slowly, we're very rapidly degrading the planet. So sustainability, in fact, is not an endpoint that we can define. I think we have to say that it is a journey or a process.
Because we still haven't, we clearly haven't achieved it yet, right?
Well, that's for sure. And so we're all flailing about to some degree.
So here's a question. I mean, not in this generation or the prior couple, but let you know, probably not for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution we talked about last time. So would you call the relationship between pre-European inhabitants of North America and their world sustainable?
Based on what we know, they were. Let me read a statement from that book, Kat Anderson's book, that is particularly meaningful to me. She said, Native Americans, actually she was speaking about California Native Americans in particular, believe that when humans are gone from an area long enough, they lose the practical knowledge about correct interaction, and the plants and animals retreat spiritually from the earth, or they hide from humans. When intimate interaction ceases, the continuity of knowledge passed down through generations is broken, and the land becomes wilderness. Now, it's interesting that we have our idea of wilderness is nature is out there. In fact, the very existence of the national park system, as wonderful as these parks are, is an indication that we have misunderstood our relationship with life. We say to the trees and the animals in the park, you stay there.
Yep, one more time, the tree zoo that we've talked about a couple
times. Yeah, we put them in a tree zoo with a fence around them, and maybe we allow snowmobiles now and then in the parks and some hunting, but in reality what we're trying to do is we say, you stay there while we go out here, and pardon me, we screw it up.
So what we're really trying to do here is get us in a mindset, a frame of mind, for addressing how we can be in reciprocal relationship with the natural world by understanding that we're not separate from it when we're designing our places, our buildings, and developing our towns, etc.
So the process of sustainable design is one where we have to re-engage ourselves differently in the world than we think about the world now.
So last time we talked about this book, 1491, and we told a brief story about how the European settlers, when the explorers first came, have in their journals recording that basically the entire east coast of what we now call America, from almost Florida all the way up to Maine, was densely developed, occupied. They could see it from their ships, recorded it, buildings, etc. But they landed. And, of course, the problem was that they brought with them what?
Disease.
Yeah, primarily smallpox.
So
80 years later, when the settlers showed up, nobody was here because, based upon the current studies, 80 to 90% of those folks were dead. So what we can do is from that, understand how were they living here, because we also have a lot of the journals from the early settlers who talked about things like very common trees in the Great Eastern Forest being 30 and 40 feet in diameter. I mean, that was completely common. So those of you who live in the Northeast, when's the last time you saw a tree?
And William Penn writes in his journal that you could drive a four-in-hand wagon, in other words, a four-horse wagon, through the woods of New Jersey and Pennsylvania. There were that few trees.
So I began to really start to play with this a little bit. I live on 30 acres in central Pennsylvania, and about half of which are wooded. And the way it's organized is the road, and then there's about 5 acres of woods on a slight slope, and then a meadow, and then the house. So I called my friend Jerry Wilhelm, who will be joining us here in a moment, and asked him to come and help me understand how I could begin to restore first, that was my thinking at the time, and then later learned how I could begin to truly regenerate the health of this place and really be a participant in it. So I asked Jerry to come, and he did. So he spent a couple of days with me, and we walked the property for a couple of days and discovered that we were losing about an inch of topsoil a decade in that front 4 acres of forest. And the reason is, you can see it, that the forest floor, there's nothing growing on it. And the reason for that is, well, we held a light meter out there and got 20 foot candles on a foliated summer day. Well, Bill, do you know how many foot candles you need on the forest floor for healthy plant life?
I don't, but let me guess, 1,500?
About 200, at least. So there's a full order of magnitude less light, and the reason is because no one has tended that forest at all for about 300 years, and you can see it. There are a couple of 200-year-old white oak trees that all the lower branches are dead due to shade rot. So what we have been able to discover is that the Native Americans actually managed the forest for hundreds, thousands of years, as Jerry might say, for time out of mind. So, Jerry, with that said, we'd like to introduce you and ask you to say hi to folks. And I have a quick question for you, and that is, how was it that you discovered how the pre-European occupants of North America were indeed in relationship with what we now call nature?
You've been doing this a long time, Jerry.
Yeah.
Before these books came out, as far as I know.
Yes. Well, it's good to talk with you guys. I sure do appreciate you just having produced that book on integrative design. I've been going through it, and it's just a beautiful book and really addresses a lot of these issues. But what got me thinking about it initially was that very quickly I noticed in a lot of our woodlands that all of the so-called woodland plants were out in the meadows or along the trail where there was a lot more light. And I began to wonder why all our so-called woodland plants were not in the woodlands. And then I started looking at some of the early data and found out that those very woodlands had been shaded out since the time of settlement substantially, perhaps 180 to 210 four-inch trees per acre as opposed to perhaps between 12 and 40, or 12 and 50 trees per acre, 4 inches or more. And in fact, in the general land survey notes throughout the Midwest, it was not uncommon for the general land surveyor to go through along a whole mile in a section line survey and not mention a tree in a woodland that he called heavy timber.
Okay, Jerry, I'm going to have to interrupt you for just a sec because we have to take a break.
Yeah.
So we'll be back shortly, folks. And you're listening to Building Deeper Green on Voice America.
Are you thinking green? Want to become a host expert on the Green Talk Network? Contact Jeff Spinard, president of our internet radio division, at 480-294-6417. That's 480-294-6417. Or click on How to Become a Host on our homepage. You're listening to the Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
Hey, y'all. This is Stephen Cochran. As a country artist, I have traveled around this great country of ours, often meeting our brave men and women in uniform. And as a Marine and veteran of both the Iraq and Afghan conflict, I know how important it is to thank our troops who defend our freedom each and every day. One of the best ways to thank them is to give their children and spouses the gift of education. Scholarships for 2 years, 4 years, and vocational school. This is exactly what a national charity, Thanks USA, does. Please go to their website, www.thanksusa.org. to make a generous donation to the Thanks USA Scholarship Fund for the families of the troops, and I thank you.
If you're thinking of starting a business or are already in business, tune in as the Kitchen Table Entrepreneur addresses business ownership concerns. Business novice or not, let the Kitchen Table Entrepreneur help you each week as we present and discuss the meat and potato issues of starting and running a business. Join the discussion. There's always room for your thoughts and opinions. The Kitchen Table Entrepreneur is a valuable program you should be tuning into every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific on the Voice America Business Network.
Attention shoppers, if anyone is missing a rather plump set of love handles, please come to the customer service counter and claim them. The ample love handles were lost in the produce department where their former owner had purchased fruits and veggies to munch on during the big game. Thank you and have a good day.
Small step number 81, snack on fruits and veggies. It's just one of the many small steps you can take to get healthy. Learn more at www.smallstep.gov.
public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Welcome to the Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, everyone. We are talking with our guest, Dr. Gerald Wilhelm, Jerry, from Conservation Design Forum, a botanist, hydrologist, and Native American scholar. And right before the break, Jerry was talking with us about the number of trees in the forest that he began to identify. And Jerry read a couple of things about the number of trees there were, for example, per acre in the Great Eastern Forest and the Louisiana Purchase. I guess the Jefferson's crews were able to discover. Can you tell us a little bit about that? It's a surprising number.
Well, it had to do with the fact that, of course, the Indians and the native people who lived in this area prior to our having come here had to have all resources within walking distance of where they lived. And those in the North Country, of course, had to have enough wood for cooking and heating and building things, enough BTUs to keep them warm on a long 6-month Illinois or Ohio winter, not to mention one in Ontario. And so they kept the woods open enough and light enough, usually upwards around, maybe about 800 to 1,000 foot candles of light, about 10% of what is ambient in the open prairie. And this allowed what they call the women's plants, or a lot of the spirit plants, the food plants, the dye plants, so many of the plants needed for the culture to sustain the people. And so it was a whether they were burning, and in many areas, well, they burned from Plymouth to Denver, and then they also, of course, harvested.
When you say burning, you mean lighting fires?
They we've done studies and specific studies in Illinois and Iowa and Missouri, and virtually 100% of all accounts of fire at the time of or before settlement were that they were Indian set in autumn annually,
and it didn't harm the trees, right?
All throughout the entire landscape. The trees tended to dispose themselves in those areas where the soils are fairly well drained. Much of the prairie soils were pretty wet and too wet for trees. But the areas along rivers, along the bluffs of rivers or on rises out in the prairie, there were groves of trees that were sufficiently well watered yet well drained to sustain the growth of oaks. And
well, plus, there, from what I can tell, there wasn't enough fuel on the forest or prairie floor to burn more than a quick
cold fire.
Flame. Yeah.
Well, it was the amount of fire, the way you'd register a fire or index it would be the amount of BTUs, and the BTUs produced are directly proportional to the flame length. And generally, through those timbers, the flames that were 30, even 40 feet high out in the prairie, going through the prairie grasses, would drop to about 3 or 4 feet high in the sedges that dominated the forest floor.
Well, it's nice to have a scientist talking about this. I got to tell you a quick story. Can I do that, John, for a second?
Sure.
We were working with a client in central New Jersey and explained that the native peoples were burning, had a burning regimen in New Jersey, and this was a family that we were working with, and one of the daughters said, well, how did they know that? You know, kind of the perception that, how do people understand nature like that?
How do they know what?
That fire would be good, you know, a burning regimen.
Yeah, I want to ask Jerry in a minute why it's good, but go ahead.
But this is interesting. And the kid, one of the sons said, who they'd owned this farm for years, he said, well, when I was 8 years old, the lower 40 hayfield burned, and we had great crops for 2 years afterwards. He said, so I knew then burning was a good thing.
Well, the other thing is, when they didn't burn, when they didn't burn in the north temperate districts, now, of course, it's different down in Florida and Alabama and Tennessee, the different rhythm, but up in the north temperate country where we had winters, if the Indians didn't burn right after the first hard frost, it was their pattern to burn after the first hard frost, they would be what they call, we call the Indian summer. It'd get warm again, and there'd be a fresh crop of green palatable grass for the elk and the bison all winter. The big snowplow heads of the bison could just move that snow aside and eat. And of course, because of the somewhat blackened ground and the new green growth, there's a strong sward of grasses for the ground nesting birds in spring. And then, of course, the ant, since the fire was annual and burning only through the elevated fine fuel of the season, the fires were scudding fires, all of the heat going upwards. 40-foot flames could go over ice with frost on the ice and not melt it. All the heat upward. And, of course, if the Indians would have waited, even 1 year, they would have probably starved to death during the winter and would have had a hard time getting around in any event. So it would have been almost physically impossible for a people who depended upon all the resources being within walking distance to have sustained life, even having missed one burn.
Yeah. And a lot of this is described in a book that Jerry gave me at one point called Fire in America, and it's written by Stephen J. Pyne, P-Y-N-E. And Jerry, you often, when you talk about this, you talk about the brothers and sisters. And could you?
Yeah, the Native people, as you mentioned already, had no idea about wildness or wilderness or park or nature as such. They really thought of themselves as part of that which the Great Spirit had created, as well as all of the others. I'm reminded of a story when reading about the life of Tecumseh, when in the late 1700s, after all the interaction with the white folks from Kentucky and whatnot, they were pretty sure that all of the animals were people, sort of like themselves, just different, with different languages and the way they looked like. However, they were starting to have doubts about squirrels.
Why?
But no, they just saw them as just part of the family that needed to be cared for. And as Kat talked about in one of her earlier books about this subject called Before the Wilderness, the grandmothers of the Pomo Indians told her that if you took care of all the brothers and sisters and learned what made them cry, what made them happy, they'd take care of you. And this is, she was talking about all the plants and animals, all of the brothers and sisters. And
so Jerry, what do we? To me, this is profound information and a profound perspective. What does that? But people say, many people would say, well, that was back then. We live differently now, and we aren't going to be burning suburbia. How do we actually approximate that kind of? Develop that relationship again.
Yeah, and Jerry,
well,
how
we are burning
in suburbia.
We're burning in downtown
work.
Chicago, etc. But the important thing about this is that I've learned this just as a botanist, is that while ecologists can sit in the universities with coiffed beards and think great thoughts and have deep theories, they're not accountable for them. So what I have found is that each and every plant, there's about 1,000 species native to each county, and if you learn the stories of each species, you learn a true way of the place where they're growing, and these plants are not ego-driven, tenure-tracked. They don't lie. They tell you only little truths, and so you can learn by learning the plants and animals. You can learn how we as a people must behave in the place where we find ourselves, so long as we nurture the brothers and sisters well and make them laugh, if you will, and not make them cry. The extent to which we are bucking this trend, the extent to which we are ignoring it. What's that?
Or ignoring it.
Or ignoring it is the extent to which we at our own peril, fall into a milieu of unsustainable behavior with the very place within which we find ourselves. That's the other aspect, is whether you're talking about an area the size of an acre or a square meter or a square mile, all spaces, if it's still inhabited by native plants and animals, are unique to the world. They are no one place, even next to another, and what an ecologist would call a mesic prairie, for example, or a mesic forest, would be 70% similar to the next one. They're all things, just like every child born of the womb is different, so are all places on the earth. The extent to which we become, disengage from the places where we are and try to make places rather than discover places, the extent to which we try to reform places rather than nurture places, then that is part of the reason we're having so much trouble. If we're just working against that which what the Greeks call numinous elements that govern spaces and govern places, to which we and ancient peoples had to be attentive, and of course local peoples in this country were attentive.
Okay, so we're going way back before European settlement. This, you even mentioned the Greeks there, but I guess the question I'm wondering is, your work that you do every day, what are you trying to accomplish, or what are you hoping to occur? What outcome are you working towards?
Well, what I would like to do, of course, if I had my druthers, would have every child who starts school and preschool begin to learn the native plants and animals. They can do this, and because only through the knowledge of them will they become empathetic with the place where they live and start to understand it.
This is a change or a transformation that
it's a transformation. We who grew up in the 60s and who were drawn out of our malaise by Rachel Carson and caused to take a look are having to make cultural paradigm shifts. It's very important, I think, for the next generation not to have such trouble doing this.
And I would like to come back on that note, Jerry, but expand it. Now, what do we do who live in cities?
We're going to hold that one for the break.
Hold on to that. We'll be right back.
So we'll be right back, folks. You're with Building Deeper Green with John Becker, Bill Reed, and our guest, Jerry, Dr. Jerry.
This is the Green Talk Network, helping to provide a sustainable future for us all. If you're thinking of starting a business or are already in business, tune in as the Kitchen Table Entrepreneur addresses business ownership concerns. Business novice or not, let the Kitchen Table Entrepreneur help you each week as we present and discuss the meat and potato issues of starting and running a business. Join the discussion. There's always room for your thoughts and opinions. The Kitchen Table Entrepreneur is a valuable program you should be tuning into every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific on the Voice America Business Network.
Hi, I'm Wendy Bellissimo with Nesting.com, proud sponsor of March of Dimes' premier walking event, March for Babies, formerly known as Walk America. You know, more babies begin healthy lives because of March of Dimes' research and programs. And with our support, we can do even more for families all over America. One day, all babies will be born healthy, but we have to walk to get there. Join the March for Babies. Sign up at marchforbabies.org.
Where can you discuss environmental, ethical, and economic issues with the leading thinkers on these topics? Join host Shane Snipes for One Greener Radio. This program will spotlight key areas such as social impact and environmental ideas, as well as social entrepreneurship. Come on board for lively and engaging discussions with Shane and his experts. One Greener Radio promises to keep you thinking and brainstorming for more. One Greener Radio is broadcast live every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Green Talk Network.
The Green Talk Network is here. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
The Green Talk Network is here. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Well, we're back chatting with our guest today, Dr. Jerry Wilhelm from Conservation Design Forum. And just before the break, Bill, you had a great question. You said, how does this affect our work in cities? We get asked that all the time, right?
Right. Most of our clients are in cities, and we're talking about nature. And remember, nature's out there to most of us. So what does that mean for us who live amongst buildings and concrete?
Well, part of what Conservation Design Forum does, of course, is everywhere it rains, receive every drop of water as a resource. Ever since Jefferson, really, this is a longer story, but we've been in the doctrine of collect, convey, and discharge water away since 1972, the Clean Water Act, or the Water Pollution Control
Bill. Yeah, and sure, there's no way away, right?
Well, that's right. That's why we're having a lot of trouble we have with our dirty water and foul rivers and dead spots and Gulfs of Mexico.
And by the way, we pay for the privilege of pushing the water away from us, which is really what we need. So we're actually paying for the privilege of messing up our ecosystems further.
Oh, it's goofy, but in 72 we started to take another look at it, but even so the doctrine of collect, convey, and discharge sustained, and so all young, brilliant, and bright engineers of the time just come up with better, what they call BMPs, or practices of collecting and conveying water away just less badly. Sort of like Bill McDonough talks about, you don't get turned around going north if you're headed south simply by slowing from 75 miles an hour down to 40
right,
or 30.
Right. In fact, the word best management practices, used the term BMPs, is actually kind of a silly term. Yeah. Pamela Mang, one of our partners, says there are only such things as better management practices.
Right, exactly. So we need to change the doctrine, and part of how you receive rain in the cities and in the suburbs is understand every it rains on every surface. And, of course, you probably are aware of the new sort of green roof technologies and whatnot that are coming along. Those have been defined in English as either extensive, intensive, or semi-intensive. However, what we're coming to find is that as the need for food and water treatment collection and energy is an energy collection, if you will, in the cities, rather than building roofs for $8 a square foot of tar paper or ugly stuff, make them beautiful places that receive the rain, receive the sun, receive the water, or grow plants or grow food, or even can be handling having wastewater wetlands. So 30% of most cities are simply wasted space. And so we need to start, when we're building buildings, think of that those roof areas as developable space to provide the kinds of amenities that we know we need to bring back to the cities. It also relates to how we design our parkways and our streets and our sidewalks, a lot more use of more permanent porous paving and parking gardens and the like, and making right now, most cities build things out of asphalt, maybe 10 years. It starts getting ugly the second year. It's too ugly to stand by the 10th year. So they take money that otherwise could have been for discretionary uses on other public and social needs and reinvest it in asphalt.
Right, right. You know, one of the things you mentioned, Jerry, about education being essential, especially with the youth, is that in urban areas, we don't think of education as necessarily a sustainable process, but in fact, it is the only sustainable process. So I think what you're saying is that all these activities that we can do in urban areas really help begin to reassociate people with the natural flows and processes of life. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, absolutely. The fact that, you guys are probably better into this than I am, but the whole phenomenology of a building and building programs is probably going to change. And it'll be probably less about the building and the ego of the architect, more about the program and how it interlinks with the needs of life.
Right, the larger systems that the building is part of becomes the dominant force, not the building itself.
Or even how the programs that go on in that building are related to other programs. The only thing that I've learned in 60 years is that what we see 10 years from now will not be what we see today. So there's, if we get our head on straight and develop an appropriate doctrine within which to place and develop all thoughts, things will be pretty different. Also, as you say, Bill, a baby coming from the womb today in 25 years will change the world. So it doesn't take long if our babies become aware of these things pretty early. They'll graduate 12th grade or 16th grade without any question as to the pitch they're trying to hit.
You know, one of the schools that we've worked on is the Willow School, and they do systems education. They do living systems education. It's remarkable how powerful those kids are in terms of what they know. They run rings around the teachers, actually.
Well, I imagine, and the other thing is, I know you're trying to bring daylight back into the classrooms, but you know, if you go from, 25-foot candles to 50, test scores go up notably. But no child, even those who grew in woodlands, no Ojibwe child or Shawnee child had to endure less than 1,000 foot candles of light, even in a closed canopy forest, because they were so open. So all the optic nerve and the brain, the resolution within which children observe things and could grasp the world occurred at about 1,000 foot candles of light, minimum 10,000 in the open. And now we're putting our babies in caves and expecting them to be intelligent. So getting our children outdoors and making light part of their lives again becomes also, I think, very important.
Well, Jerry, that is directly in line with what we're going to be talking about in our next episode, which is how do we create healthy habitat, and understanding that the indoor environmental quality is not really separate from the outdoor environmental quality. It's all one habitat. And what you just touched upon hits that square on the head.
Yeah, we separate habitats now.
Yeah. By the way, a couple things. You talked about how you think that the profession is changing of architecture, so there's not so much a form, object, or I think you used the word ego-driven. And I just wanted to mention that one of our colleagues, Carol Franklin, once said that you can't address ecosystems if you're dealing with ecosystems.
Leave it to Carol.
It's really all of us understanding that we are, and this is a term that thought of again, we like to call it remembering.
Re-dash-membering.
So it's remembering that we indeed are members of this guild of guilds called nature.
Well, and let's don't forget that in re-remembering, let's talk about rediscovery, because rediscovering the native plants and animals, I'll just stick up for them one more time, they are the only true tellers of the way. They told the grandmothers and the grandfathers early on the stories of the place and informed them of the true and a way in which to relate to the water, the sun, and all the things. And by learning and re-engaging with them, we don't have to make a place, we don't have to create it anew, we can simply learn to nurture the one we're in.
Jerry, when you just started talking about the way I think, and you can help me here, but I think the way the native peoples communicated the way was through story. Is that
mm-hmm.
true?
Absolutely. Before there was written language, do I have time to tell just one quick story?
I want to touch on story somewhat.
Okay. Tecumseh took these books written by getting along the Ohio River, took his older brother, Jiktika, and said, look, Jiktika, what the white man can do. He can make the white man, next white man knows what he says without even the lips moving. And he said, and Jiktika would be impressed, but he was appalled. He said, Tecumseh, this is why the white man's so confused. It deprives from the elder the way to tell the story and the poetic and the way that the children can see. He said the white man traps the words from out of the air and puts them on with edges on him and on the words, just like he does the land. And it makes it hard to communicate. And not only that, he said, you can't look into the eyes of the man who wrote those words to see if he's been listening to bad birds. And not only that, anyone can read the words, even when the elder knows he's not ready. And so the told story by an elder with a careworn hand on the shoulder of a little one who trusts utterly the wisdom of the elder, and the elder, of course, is utterly incorruptible in terms of passing it along, is the way stories and wisdom and knowledge were passed along.
Oh, and Jerry, you have served as an elder of sorts for me for the past few years.
Well, I think it's kind of mutual.
Well, I want to ask you, what by the way, how do you make this part of your work? So, for example, what are you doing today?
Well, right now I'm down in Tippecanoe County, speaking of Tecumseh, Tippecanoe County, Indiana, beginning a natural area survey of the remnant prairies and fens and woodlands along the Wabash. Those, of course, most of the folks don't realize what they have here. They have some beautiful remnant landscapes. They're badly mismanaged. They've been neglected. But discovering them and learning to manage them and re-engage ourselves in their health and well-being, these folks will see that they have landscapes, woodlands, and prairies, and beautiful wetlands, the likes of which go nowhere else on Earth. This can develop a sense of local pride, and also, of course, these are irreplaceable assets that cannot be restored once they've been obliterated. And so they begin to see the value in linking up their corridors, their greenways, and their trails. Kiosks and informational areas and adjacencies to schools can begin to see how attending to these aboriginal assets and still refugia where these native plants and animals still grow, there'll be a time beyond mine in the next generation.
So you're actually helping by virtue of doing this work for that community to indeed remember, reestablish their relationship with the natural world around them.
Yes, and develop a pride in it. And not an abstract pride or an abstract, but see that this is really part of the Wabash.
Yeah, the minute when we see things as abstract, if we see that wetland out there as just an engineering technique, or you know, I think the word ecological service is actually does a disservice to us. We use that now as a way. Well, we're going to mimic ecological services. Well, that's a start, but it really still separates us from that understanding.
Yes, it keeps that apartheid pretty tight.
Well, it's time for us to take another break. I'd like to come back and chat about that a little bit more, the idea of ecological service and our relationship with the land on which we live. So let's take a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
The Green Talk Network is here. Spread the green.
Do you know what it takes to reach massive success? Do you know that if you change your thinking,
you can change your life?
The Development Connection with host Amy Himes will give you the keys to reach ultimate success. Each show will feature topics to help you reach personal, career, and business ownership success. And you'll learn how to enlarge your vision to move ahead in life and within your organization. The Development Connection with Amy Himes is live every Monday on Voice America at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific. Listen today and move forward tomorrow.
Over there's the water. Whoosh, whoosh. And look at all this stuff I'm standing on. It's called sand, and it's everywhere.
This woman may sound silly to you and me.
It's made up of little tiny pieces of rocks. Teeny little pieces of rocks.
But to her 2-year-old son exploring the world around him, she makes perfect sense.
How does it feel when you touch the sand? Is it warm?
Uh-huh.
It's hard to hold in your hand, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Learning starts long before school does, and children are naturally curious. They want to learn, so follow their lead. Take simple, everyday moments, like sorting laundry or playing on the beach, and turn them into learning moments.
Is this water?
No.
Very good. This is sand. Oh, no, it's not food. It's sand. We don't eat sand.
Turn everyday moments into learning moments. Find out how at pornlearning.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Income Property Investment Talk with Peter Mosca and Dean Issa provides homeowners and investors eager to invest well in real estate the knowledge, resources, and tools necessary to generate significant wealth. Our focus will be the paradigm. Live where you want. Invest where it makes the most sense. Listen live to the brightest minds in real estate investment every Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel. That's Income Property Investment Talk with Peter Mosca and Dean Issa, where America learns to invest.
Eco-conscious trends and lifestyles. You are listening to the Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
So right before we took a break, Bill and Jerry, our guests, were talking about things. They were talking about the relationship of humans and natural systems, the remembering idea, and also this notion that often is thought about of nature providing us with free services, things like, let's say, purifying water. But what else would be a free?
Providing fresh air, cooling breezes, soil for food.
So I want to tell a little story here about how profoundly this sort of set of notions changed my life, actually, and it was as a result of Jerry coming and visiting my house that I talked about earlier. Now, what Jerry showed me was that on every single square meter of these 30 acres, and we didn't walk all of it, but a number of them, every single square meter was its own little ecosystem with a different set of flora and fauna. And simply by showing me that and having me understand what was there, I began to really fall in love with this place in a way that I thought I was doing. I wanted to do something to this place. Rather, after this experience with Jerry, I really loved this place in ways that I never could have imagined. So I now feel much more as if I'm actually working with the brothers and sisters, and it's not as if I'm looking to them to provide a service for me.
You're being with the place, right?
Yeah, that's what it's become. And it's that relationship that really changed the way I thought about how I could participate in the health of this place.
Yeah, you know, when Einstein said we needed that we can't solve the problem with the same mind that created it, I think he was being very literal. And we actually do need to shift our whole worldview. And this is why we have Dr. Wilhelm on the show with us today, because of his this deep perspective that's required for us. Because if we don't understand something, we aren't going to love it. So it's a process. This whole design process of sustainability is remembering the old way of understanding, so that we actually do fall in love, and what we're in love with, we take care of. So when we call things ecological services, it's once removed. It's a technology. It's a
abstract
thing that we do, John.
Abstract, right?
Yeah, it's abstracted. It's not
but
real.
Jerry, let's ask you one final question while we still have you, and it might be something like, what is the mental model shift you had to make to be effective, and how did you transform yourself and your company or your colleagues in this process to begin to approach it in this way?
Well, I just think that it's the growing, almost disturbing awareness that it was through a study of the actual plants and animals native to a place that began to inform me of things that were uncorrupt and not governed by doctrine or some reductionist, Descartesian or Cartesian perception or description of things. And also, you already mentioned, Bill, you can't help when you start looking at these organisms and these plants and animals, loving them and caring for them. And it's really more less about them providing us services and more about the healing of ourselves as we learn to care for them and ourselves. And so it's less about conservation, less about even restoration. In fact, we cannot restore those Aboriginal plant communities. It's not possible. Once they're gone, they're gone. We can restore a facsimile, and we can restore some function, but we need to learn how to do that better and better. But we also must learn how to preserve, I suppose, recognize, preserve, and learn to care for those places that are.
Yet, Jerry, we've lost so much that there is still certainly systems to conserve.
Yes.
But it seems like we really need to reimagine ourselves as a people so that we can actually begin to bring back our relationship to increase the diversity and resiliency of these systems, or else we really are not going to achieve a sustainable condition.
Right now we can't. The soils aren't here. Our mind isn't here, but we need to. But the only teachers, the only avenue, the only tools left in the toolbox are those places that still harbor remnants, where Aboriginal diversity still exists. However beaten, bloody about the head and shoulders, we need to discover them, readdress them, and learn how to manage them, learn how to take care of them, and they will teach us. And then in so doing, I've already seen this in my own life, that over the last 35 years or so, when you begin to heal the soil and heal your own spirit about how this works, you can do better restoration than if you just do it in a clinical or a production sort of way.
Jerry, that's a perfect place for us to say goodbye to you.
All right.
And we really thank you very much for your wisdom today.
You're welcome, guys.
Having you, Jerry.
We'll be talking to you. Good luck, guys.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
So, we have four episodes coming up here, and you may recall from the first episode when we outlined the arc we were on.
Oh, yeah, they have it all memorized, I'm sure.
Yeah. So, what we're looking for here is to discuss what we talked about as the four key subsystems of the whole. Again, you can't really, it's so hard to grasp the whole that we need to look at the pieces, but if you're just seeing the pieces, you can't get the whole. So Those four key subsystems that we're going to talk about are
based on the four universal principles or laws that the alchemists came up, earth, wind, fire, and water, and they come down to our practical translation in the earth, the soil, the habitat, the quality of the quality of air, which deals with our energy usage, quality of water, which is water, and materials, which is also part of the earth, but it's how we revalue the earth.
So in simple words, they are habitat, water, energy, and materials. And this program was a segue to the next in us understanding that habitat is both human and other biotic systems.
So we're going to be having Keith Bowers from Biohabitats for our next episode, who will be one of the early restoration scientists and landscapers in the country, and works all over the world, and we'll be talking about the nature of how we practically introduce this restoration process. This is a practical process, and that's something that we want to really emphasize, that this is not some kind of idealistic approach out there, waving our arms in the air and hoping for the best. That if we're going to achieve a sustainable condition, if we're serious about sustainability, then we have to go here. We have to go to these places.
This is what Jerry was doing today, discovering what was in this place in a way that he could help others discover with whom they were in relationship, and with whom in this case happened to be what the Native Americans called their brothers and sisters.
Yeah, so how do we do that? What is the process that we use, can we use as we engage our buildings? Now, why are two architects talking like this? And you want to answer that question, John?
Well, I know why I am. What about you?
Okay, well, I'm talking about it because I started down this road of sustainability thinking that energy efficiency was what I needed to do.
I did the same thing.
And realized, I don't know if we've used this analogy before, but Easter Island was a carbon neutral island. And it's time to realize that we need to go further than just carbon neutral.
Well, we'll see you next time, folks. And remember, to do different things, we need to do things differently.
To do things differently, we need to think about them differently.
And to think differently, we need to be different. See you next week.
Thanks, all.
For tuning in this week to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. Please join us again next Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Green Talk Network, and make it a great and greener weekend.